It's 8:20. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Board of Education held a 2-half-day retreat last week and then met yesterday in a regular session. None of the 5 elected school board members could be here for a follow-up interview, so thank you to Superintendent Jill Gilday for filling in. And she joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So are you all moved in?
No. Just starting to get settled. Still in your mattress. We'll be okay, though.
Yeah. The new home is in Jeremy Ranch, as we've reported. How much input did you have in the house that was purchased? I'm guessing location was important to you since your husband commutes to Salt Lake City.
Right. I had the opportunity to peek in at several properties that were available. I believe the district reviewed about 25 different properties.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because the district was looking for an investment. You were looking for a home. Did you have to sacrifice anything so that those goals could be realized?
Yes. Yes, but it's absolutely lovely. The street is amazing. Amazing people, amazing neighbors. And I'm sure that would have been found throughout the town. But this is that's a great benefit, to be sure.
Yeah, and then for the record, and because people keep asking me, you and your husband are paying for all of the utilities and maintenance of the house. So if the hot water heater or the dishwasher were to go out, you would be responsible for that?
Exactly, as well as there's a tax benefit, certainly, that I will be paying to the state for having this benefit from the community, of course.
Okay, let's start with yesterday's board meeting. The board voted unanimously, with the exception of board member Ann Peters, who was absent, on the early literacy program after a very long discussion about both the Dibbles and Foundations program. I believe Foundation is the program that was adopted as a pilot program at McPullen Elementary in 2016, rolled district-wide into the first and second grades. This is the third year, then, where teachers are getting up to speed and learning the new system. School board member Petra Butler questioned the two specialists yesterday, Tracy Evans, the Associate Superintendent of Teaching and Learning, and Elementary Curriculum Specialist, Julie, and I'm sorry I don't have her name, to explain what they're going to do to address the 25 or 30% of students who aren't showing yearly progress. I believe you responded that there is not one reading program that a one-size fits all for kids. So what's the plan to address these students who don't meet the reading benchmarks and by third grade?
Correct. So basically you are referencing a K-3 district early literacy plan that every district across Utah submits based on legislative regulations that talks about how each district will address the 7 core areas that help develop readers. So that is everything that you mentioned, from Foundations, which incorporates phonological awareness and phonics, which some of the programs do not include in a traditional reading basal program. So this is something that the district probably 3 or 4 years ago identified as a need and then brought in this additional pilot or this additional support to buffer, you know, those skills and strategies for kids. And then the next pieces, of course, are that fluency of reading and the accuracy of reading. And then we can't forget, you know, vocabulary enhancing, because the academic content vocabulary helps kids grow. And then you can't focus only on fluency and accuracy and forget about comprehension. You know, so all of these things basically provide a balanced literacy program, which is why I think no one reading program can do everything for every student. I think what this does, the other thing that's included, which is a wonderful benefit in Utah, is including writing as part of the literacy program, because we all know that when we write, you know, that is basically putting your thinking down in words, and we can really help a child develop additional strategies, scaffolding, and critical thinking skills when they're writing, because then we can ask a question and, you know, gather their thinking and ask them to write something down. So it also includes that.
So between these two programs, then, we should be able to reach all students and see annual progress?
Well, the best thing, if you also probably listened and heard the follow-up to this, is it's not just about a literacy course or a reading class, in isolation. It's about what we do with whole child development and whole child philosophy. So all of these scaffolds and supports are going to provide the universal Tier 1 curriculum for all students, and then helps us develop additional inputs and strategies for those kids who aren't getting it right away or who might be falling behind. And then again, an additional layer of more interventions and supports called Tier 3, if that is needed. So this in combination with a multi...
Hi, you still there?
Those are strategies that transform the classroom into a more modernized, student-friendly environment that helps each student reach their potential.
Board Member Petra Butler also asked yesterday why the interventionists weren't up and running and ready to address this handful of kids who aren't meeting the baseline reading competency. I think part of that was her concern about hiring so many new staff members all at once and getting them all on board. So have we been able to do that? Is that part of the problem here?
Right. So some of these people are growing within the system, so they are not brand new to Park City. So not everybody comes in brand new to be an interventionist or literacy specialist. These are people that have acquired additional education and training and move into these roles. So it's a little different onboarding someone who's brand new, than moving into this more specialized role. But this is a pretty common position to have in most districts. So it is not a reinventing the wheel kind of position. It's something that we're used to in the field. We have had people who have specialized in literacy and reading across the nation for at least 20, 25 years. My master's is also in early literacy acquisition.
So have all of the openings been filled that we had for interventionists?
Yes, all of our positions are filled in the district.
Yeah. Petra Butler also asked to see a breakdown of all full-time employees that have been hired, and my understanding is that will be discussed at the next board meeting.
What Member Butler was asking about is she's very interested in those part-time positions versus a full-time position and trying to see how many individuals we have working in the district for maybe only 2 or 3 hours a day versus a full 6 or 8 hour day. So trying to, again, review the efficiency, effectiveness, and deployment of classified staff across the district.
All right. Business Administrator Todd Halber reported the district has purchased some new propane buses. Are these
Correct. That's something new. That's a pilot with the district. And we are looking at the electric buses for schools are not quite there yet as a standard. But we do have propane as an opportunity, as a great environmental option. So we'll be trying two of those buses out.
Okay. Are these replacements or in addition to?
These are replacements.
Yeah, certainly cleaner burning than diesel. But my guess is propane a lot more expensive than diesel. Yeah? How will these?
Not really. Yeah, not really, actually. And that's why I think it becomes a viable alternate. I think it's more the accessibility of the propane that most communities work on. You just have to have a place, a filling station, either on-site or off-site that's able to get you that that refill when needed.
You mentioned a future education summit that would include students and teachers. When is this scheduled for and where, who'll be a part of it?
Right. The date is still to be scheduled. So as soon as we know the date, we will certainly let you know. It's looking like mid-October. And this is a facilitated dialogue with our external partners who are working on the master plan process, really trying to start this with visioning education today and tomorrow, and then working with those concepts as pillars for not only the strategic direction of the district, but also the facility needs that ultimately may result from that or may affirm everything that we have is perfect.
So that is part of the master planning effort then?
Yeah, absolutely is. And so the board and community is really starting with the vision of a successful future.
Some teachers expressed concern that there was no teacher representative on the master planning committee. Was that intended, or will we add a teacher or two?
you know, there will definitely be teachers. There is a small steering committee of, I believe it is 21 individuals that are working with these outsourced partners on the master facility plan process. It's a community-based group. We also have a parallel track, which includes many educators, that the educators we're having to roll out that plan for them. But it is basically 6 3-hour sessions, so about 18 hours of participation, as well as that Future of Education Summit, which is probably a 6 to 8 hour day. So there will definitely be teacher voice, teacher participation, and teacher leadership, really teacher ownership and empowerment in looking at the future of education in Park City School District. So 3 hours on pedagogy, 3 hours on curriculum, 3 hours on facility space needs. It's really quite an extensive commitment, and I really look forward to it. It's going to be wonderful to hear where we kind of rate ourselves between traditional and transformative, and then what steps we are moving along the way, just like a literacy plan, you know, trying to meet the needs of all students.
As we reported, the Park City School Board met twice last week with a paid strategy consultant to identify the board's top values and strategic goals, identified as academic success, leadership, excellent personnel, communication, and community alliances. So have these changed? I mean, they seem like similar goals over the last 20 years.
Right. Governance, you know, it's really, really a challenge to be a high-impact governance team. And I think this board demonstrates its commitment to that ideal in doing this ongoing training and support for their own development. Because, you know, everybody runs as an individual, then all of a sudden you're on this team and, you know, everything happens based on your work as a team. So I think the retreat affirmed all of those things that happened last year because, wow, there were a lot of landscapes of initiative, you know, opportunities last year that happened. So kind of reaffirmed what happened last year, helped me as a new member of this team kind of come up to speed on what the priorities are. And then we did do a lot of survey participation. So we did pre-work where board members were able to look at all of that landscape of initiatives and then prioritize those. So that helps us then focus our direction for the upcoming year and years. So, yeah, the priority setting, it has gotten complex through the years, I would agree with you.
Yeah, so and when you see them listed on the district's homepage now, it really seems like the values and the strategic goals are one of the same. I mean, is there a difference between them?
Right. I think you have to have the values in order to move your, you know, there have to be operational plans under each of these, and that's really what that next step is. And the consultant who did come in, gave us an outstanding model of an operational plan kind of cover sheet that helps us further break these out, because academic success is very broad, but then there are many areas under that, right, including what we talked about this morning with the literacy plan. That's just one aspect of academic success. There are many. And those are, as you mentioned, you know, kind of fleshed out in that academic success value.
Yeah, we certainly don't have time today to talk about all of these, but when we talk about the definition of academic excellence, there's so many ways the district's achievements could be measured. So how do we define it? I mean, what's the board thinking here?
Right, exactly. So I think we are looking at the mission and vision statements and that academic success statement and looking at all of the benchmarks that are available to us and for us. And you know, across so many measures, Park City is just doing an outstanding job. So kids are moving along a trajectory. Not everybody at the same pace in the same moment, but yet ultimately when you're looking at the pre-K-12 continuum, you are seeing some really outstanding results. So I think we look at all those things, graduation rates, test score, you know, AP participation for kids who are interested in that, all of the work that is happening in PC CAPS, you know, what kinds of projects are emanating from that. You know, the people we're putting into the world and coming back to the community to support is really the true measure of educational system success, right? It's the community that you're growing, building, and supporting for the next, you know, next generations beyond what we can even see.
And then when we talk about community relations and communications, board members all talked about the challenges of being out in the community and people coming up to them with complaints. So other than that goes with the territory, did the board decide how it deals with this, some kind of protocol, if you will?
Right. I think community relations and community input is always something that, again, newly elected public officials, you know, might question. So obviously any individual can come up with a concern, a complaint, a compliment, or feedback. And then the typical protocol, if the board would like to get something done quickly, you know, the best thing they can do is forward that information right onto the superintendent and then have the correct strategies employed in the system to ensure that we're meeting, you know, either getting back to the person, because typically a board member, you know, they are not actually doing the work. That's not their role. Their role is to govern. Their role is to look at the future. Their role is to, you know, really look at the big picture of what's happening. But if it's a complaint about a bus stop or a complaint about, anything really else really needs to come through the school system. That's the best way for the public to get their questions answered.
Yeah. And I guess,
or to get a complaint resolved, right?
Right. Yes. But since we elect our board members, I guess at some point they just need to explain their position to somebody. I mean, right? They can certainly pass it on to you.
As I said, you know, a lot of people in society right now are kind of confused about what is governance. You know, what is governance? What is leadership? What is management? And obviously, you know, governance is this very big picture, high impact. It's really important work. It's really hard work, but it's teamwork. It's nothing that any individual can do. An individual school principal can make some improvements, changes, or, you know, directional inputs to a school. But a governance team, you know, is looking, like I said, at everything. So you're right. People do need to understand roles, goals, controls, and what can really happen. But certainly, if a community member speaks to any board member, and they surface that information to the system, certainly people in the system are going to work on resolving whatever issue is emerging.
Okay, I'm out of time. I need to leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Superintendent of Schools, Jill Gilday. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Park City Magazine has a new editor, Jane Gentron, taking over after a five-year run with Melissa Fields. Jane Jones joins me now in the studio to tell us about that, as well as an upcoming fundraiser for Peace House this weekend. Good morning and congratulations.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wanted this job.
Well, I have been freelancing for 20 years, actually contributing to Park City Magazine while doing other jobs, like doing PR for the Park City Institute and various other incarnations here in Park City. And I've always loved the magazine. It's just a fabulous publication since its Lodestar days, and was just thrilled to be able to follow in the footsteps of Melissa and before her Kristen Case. So,
yeah. So basically you started last spring, I guess, when Melissa stepped down, or?
Actually, late July.
Oh, okay.
So, yes.
So you've been busy then getting this.
Yeah, it's a little bit of catch up, and but it's a great team, and Melissa really kind of had things in order, and it's going great.
So when does the fall winter edition come out?
Early December.
Okay. Anything you can tell us that we could look forward to?
Lots of things to look forward to. But I'll keep you surprised and the edge of your seats. It'll be a compilation of great features and artist profiles, habitat, food and beverage, and you know, we might just have quite a glimpse of the World Championships coming
great
forward.
Let's see. You have got a brunch planned Saturday at the Summit Watch Plaza. Tell me about this.
Yes. So on Saturday from 11 to 2. We are hosting Brunch at Altitude, which the lovely Janet Jorgensen, our publisher, has just been working her tail off to get together vendors and sponsors. And it'll be eats and drinks, and the centerpiece will be the Bloody Mary Smackdown, which is a competition between mixologists, local mixologists. They'll be judged by gosh, I think we have 5 or 6 judges now, including some of your city councilors and various other wonderful local characters. And yeah, they'll throw down and try to produce their best Bloody Mary. We also have live music. The wonderful Shannon Runyon has gathered together various musicians and what else? Lawn games, giant Jenga, cornhole, dressing up like a waffle. And then there'll be this really cool photo booth where you can have breakfast in bed anywhere in the world. So there'll be a green screen with various spots and you get your photo taken. And then, of course, there's a silent auction for the Peace House. The proceeds will go to the Peace House, and there's some great items there. So, yeah, just a really great, fun community gathering with entertainment, eats, drinks, brunch, just enjoying, and then silent auction.
So why is a competition? Why is a magazine doing this?
To celebrate our community, you know. We've been part of the community for more than 40 years, and it's just a great way to get everyone together. And, of course, the Peace House is such a great organization and what they do. So it's kind of just a great fit. Beautiful day.
What's the
hopefully.
Cost?
General admission is $35. And then there is a VIP hour. Should you choose to be a VIP and come, you get to come an hour early and peruse all the yummy eats and drinks prior to when the general admission starts at 11. So you can come in at 10, and that, the VIP is $75. So again, proceeds go to the Peace House. So it's just a fun get together, kind of peruse the bites. I know the Montage has a really interesting sounding hash, and there's a bunch of vendors, so I don't want to mention just a few and not leave out the others. And then Dented Brick has come in as a sponsor to help with our Spirits Garden.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us?
I think that pretty much covers it. Just come on out and enjoy the beautiful fall weather with us on Saturday.
Okay. Hey, Jane, thanks.
Thank you.
I guess people can get tickets online. Is that what you're
doing?
Yeah,
just go to parkcitymagazine.com/brunch.
Okay. Jane Gendron, again, the new editor of Park City Magazine. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the best-selling author of I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, Erica Sanchez, will be in Park City Thursday evening for a talk and book signing. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Erica. I think this is your first book, yes?
Actually, it's my second book. My first book was a collection of poetry that came out July of 2017, and then this came out in October. But it's my first book of fiction.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the genesis for it. Is it somewhat autobiographical?
Somewhat. I mean, I was a very difficult teen, just like the main character. She struggled with depression. I did too. But I never lost anyone. You know, she loses her sister in the beginning of the novel. And I fortunately have never lost anyone, and I've never had a sister. So that is completely fictional. But I drew upon a lot of my experiences as a teenager. I also had a very difficult relationship with my mother, just like Julia does in the novel. So yeah, I put a lot of myself in her, but I also didn't limit myself to the literal truth.
So was part of the struggle then just the differences in the Mexican, which I'm culture that I'm thinking your parents may have grew up in, and then you as kind of the American culture?
Yeah. I think that's a very common story for a lot of first-generation kids. You know, our parents come from Mexico and have a very different upbringing. And then we're born here in the United States and we're completely Americanized, and that causes a lot of conflict between parents and their children. It's pretty difficult. I know that I fought a lot with my mother about, you know, gender stereotypes and gender norms. For instance, you know, I was expected to heat tortillas up for my brother, and I felt like, why should I have to do that? You know, And so we just had a lot of tension. Now we're, you know, like great friends, but our my teenage years were pretty tough.
Yeah. The promotional materials I was reading say that you are a self-described cheerleader for young women. How so?
Well, I feel really strongly about supporting young women. I wrote this book specifically for young women of color. I mean, I hope that others would enjoy it also, but this is really dedicated to all the weird brown girls out there, because that's who I was. And I just feel like it's really important for me to talk about mental health. As a person with some sort of influence, I feel like I can make a difference. Latina teens have the highest suicide rates among their peers, and that's something that's not really talked about. So I try to bring attention to that. I hope that the story is empowering for young women. And there's a lot that I still want to do to encourage young women of color.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting to hear some of the stories that really till now haven't been told, especially by, like you say, first generation, whatever, you know, whatever culture you come from. Is there a broad market for that at this point, huh?
Yes, there is. I mean, my book has done exceptionally well. I couldn't have imagined. You know, it's a bestseller. It keeps popping back up on the list for some reason. I don't know how that happened. But yeah, I mean, there's a demand, and there's a lack of literature for people like us. And so I think it's starting to shift. And I'm excited to see that happen. I'm excited to see that people realize that our stories matter, and that not only do they matter, they sell. There's a big audience for these kinds of narratives. And so I think things are changing.
Yeah. On Thursday, can you just give us a taste of what you'll be talking about? My understanding is that you're scheduled to talk for, I don't know, 30 minutes or so, take questions and answers before you open a book signing at about 8.
Yeah, I'll be reading a little bit of my book for certain. And then, you know, I'll be talking about my life. I think I have a lot to share, especially, like I said, with young women. You know, as a person who has struggled with bipolar disorder, I feel like that's something also to be talked about. Publicly, I think mental illness is really stigmatized, and that's something that I try to push against.
Wonderful. Again, you will be at Park City Library Thursday, September 20th, starting at 7 o'clock. That'll be followed by the book signing at 8. And what are you working on now?
I'm actually working on a collection of essays, almost finished, but nonfiction is difficult in a very different way. So it's been kind of excruciating, to be quite honest.
Okay. Well, we look forward to bringing you to Park City. Erica, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
That's author Erica Sanchez again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the Park City Library. Everybody, it's free and open to everyone. It's an issue that has some unlikely supporters, and then many people who say they support medical marijuana being allowed in Utah, but not under this proposition. In the studio, one of the supporters of Prop 2, I have Dr. Andrew Talbot on the phone with me, someone who supports medical marijuana, but not this way, Representative Brad Dong. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Representative Dong, let's start with you. You have stated that your belief in the benefits of medical marijuana, but have fought hard to oppose the Prop 2 referendum. How come?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but let me just give you one basic one. Prop 2 almost cuts the doctor out of the picture. In other words, the doctor, all he can really do is give somebody a right to shop card, and then they're left to a completely untrained and potentially uninformed bud tender to decide what exactly concoction they ought to take. That, to me, is the wrong way to do it. We want the doctor heavily involved, prescribing dosages and actually doing follow-up, and Prop 2 doesn't really follow that model. So that's just one of the many problems with Prop 2.
Well, again, the state legislature had lots of time to draft their own, and the fact that you guys didn't take any action is the reason we have this. So it just seems to me that it's any complaints about Prop 2 we could blame the state legislature for now.
Well, that's really not a fair characterization. The fact is I myself and others have passed numerous bills moving towards medical cannabis. And interestingly enough, at every single step of the way, the proponents of Prop 2 have actually put up roadblocks and fought against doing anything precisely so they can put out this, what I consider to be a less than honest message that the legislature hasn't done anything. The fact is, at any time during that process, they were welcome to the table to engage in good faith negotiations. And I think that had they done so, we'd be much further down the road. But even with all of that in place, we have right now a system in place where there will be production, there will be a dispensary in operation by the middle of next year. And so really what's left to do is decide what types of conditions medical cannabis should be available for. So if nothing else happens, if Prop 2 fails, the legislature just has that one step to make to have medical cannabis available for everybody. So the fact is, we have been doing a lot. We're moving ahead, and I believe that we can finish, carry that ball across the finish line.
So we're hearing that there could possibly be a special session even before November's election day. Is that the case, to try and sort this out?
I doubt it will be before the election day, but they that's kind of a decision that's made by the governor in connection with the Senate and House leadership. I mean, they know that what the proposition is. They know what we have in store, and I think they'll have to kind of weigh that out and see what they're going to do. But I think, again, that goes to the fundamental point that we in the legislature do want to move ahead in a thoughtful and methodical way that treats cannabis medicine as closely as we treat other medicines that are now prescribed by a physician and dispensed by a pharmacist.
My understanding, you did pass legislation that allowed for access, but only for those in their last 6 months of life, which I mean, nobody can predict that. Under this legislation, what would happen if somebody doesn't die after 6 months?
You mean under the current bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously they have to have a diagnosis. And once they have the diagnosis and they're in the program, they would try it. But there again, the point I want to emphasize there is that legislation required us to put into place a full-scale production of cannabis-based medicine, full-scale processing, and a dispensary to be able to dispense it. So that, even though, yes, we can certainly say that the condition is very narrow, I will fully own that, but it does get us to the point where adding conditions becomes just simply a small step, because we have everything else in place in order to make that happen.
All right, let's bring Dr. Andy Talbot into the discussion. Andy, you work with TRUCE, a group of concerned patients and caregivers advocating for the safe legal access to medical cannabis here in the state. You say you were a patient advocate in favor of Prop 2, but not necessarily pro-cannabis. What does that mean?
Well, I'm definitely believe in cannabis as a medicine for most of our patients, especially most of my chronic pain patients. I want you to understand that I just don't think it's necessarily for every single patient. This isn't a recreational bill. This isn't something that the doctors will be pushing their patients or really having a financial windfall with their patients to put them on this medicine. This just needs to be available for all patients. And so I am an advocate for my patients as having this as their option.
Yeah. Based on the patients that you have seen use it, I mean, is it effective, or do people need oxycodone and Vicodin? And...
Well, the great point. It's not an either-or argument. I'm not anti-opioid either, but this needs to be an option for my patients. I see them use cannabis. Sometimes they come in, they're using cannabis already. I have to tell them that, look, this is illegal. They can't use it. I've had patients leave the state to go move away from their families to states where they could get this. These are people that have chronic, everyday, unrelenting pain that is, they don't have 6 months to live. They have years to live, years of pain. And so that's why the current bill that's in place, or the current law in place for the right to try at the end of life was unsatisfactory.
All right. So as Representative Dahl mentioned, do you feel like you are cut out of what Prop 2 would do?
Well, absolutely not. The Proposition 2 language states that physicians have to have an established relationship with their patients, have a thorough workup and documentation of the patient's diagnosis to determine if they're even a candidate for this. Once they get the medical cannabis recommendation, and there's an important distinction. Physicians can't write prescription because of federal law and the Controlled Substances Act, but they would get the recommendation, take it to the dispensary, and be able to get the medicine that they need. That card is not valid in perpetuity. It expires. And so the patient would have to absolutely have follow-up. But it's just the card is giving them a maximum amount of this medicine that they can get. It's not saying that they can get as much as they want or as much as they need or any types. There's going to be a database in place, so patients can't go to different marijuana or cannabis dispensaries around the state and get whatever they would like.
Yeah. Representative Dahl, if in fact it does pass Prop 2 in November, which the polls seem to show us that it has a good likelihood of happening. What does that mean? I mean, does that mean that you should then jump into special session and try to tweak it? Or?
Well, again, that's a decision left to the governor and House leadership. I mean, even on this radio show, you've heard some things that Dr. Talbot has said that need to be clarified. It is a right to shop card. For example, if a doctor says what you need is cannabidiol, they go to a dispensary, the bud tender's allowed to try to sell them whatever he can. And where he says it may not be a windfall for doctors, okay, but it's a huge windfall for dispensary owners who have every financial incentive to try to upsell them as much as possible and absolutely no legal repercussions for doing so. So those kinds of things that he's mentioned, we probably need to address and actually make that what the law actually is.
Oh, it's not written like a current prescription, you know, that you get 30 pills, you would get a certain amount of grams or whatever of the.
Well, it's written
to
give
a right
maximum.
To shop card. It's a get whatever.
No,
I mean, it does
but,
have
but
a
to a maximum amount.
It doesn't specify any.
It's not
any
unlike medications.
Like that.
If I prescribe, let's say, Percocet to a patient and I give them up to four a day, you know, one tablet every 6 hours as needed, and I give them 120 tablets, they can go to the pharmacy. That's the maximum they can get. Sometimes they get 60. Sometimes they get less if the insurance won't pay. This is not that different. They can still get a maximum amount. There's just some various types. There's different dosing forms. There's tinctures, there's oils, there's dry flour, there are extracts, there's all kinds of different things that a patient could get. So, I mean, while I guess you can call it a right to shop card, I think that's somewhat disingenuous. It's still giving them a maximum amount of what they could get every 2 weeks.
Hmm. Well, there's.
I have to respectfully disagree with that, doctor. You don't write them a Tylenol 3 and they go in and get oxycodone. You know that's the truth.
Well, those are
you
different substances.
To, this... But under Prop 2, you could write them saying you need only CBD, and they can go in and get full-strength Blue Diesel or Death Star or whatever it is. That's an entirely different drug.
I'm not familiar
so
with that,
to say
that
they're
that
the
terminology.
Same thing is, that's what I think is not exactly accurate.
Well, it's all coming from the same plant, and we know the risks of this plant, and they're very, very low. Nobody in the history of mankind has ever overdosed on this substance.
Well, there's lots to talk about. these are just two of, I think, 10 panelists. I'm not sure how far you're going to get along with that many people on the panel, but I appreciate you guys spending some time with us just to create some interest in that today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. And again, if you can't be there on Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. at St. Luke's Episcopal Church, KPCW will be broadcasting it live.